here on VOA Africa.
Today is Wednesday, December the 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated a strong U.S. commitment to its strategic partnership with Indonesia, vowing to deepen maritime cooperation with Southeast Asia's most populous nation. The U.S. Senate voted to raise the debt limit by $2.5 trillion, avoiding a default.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 49, and the joint resolution is passed.
The U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights warns Afghanistan is facing a profound human rights crisis and failure by the Taliban rulers to uphold the rights of their people, and it will lead to further turmoil and hinder the country's development.
While the Taliban takeover has brought an uneasy end to fighting against governmental forces in the country, the current situation leaves the population with little protection in terms of human rights.
And France is pulling its troops from a key military base in the northern Malian city of Timbuktu. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the U.S. Senate voted to raise the debt limit by $2.5 trillion, avoiding a default. AP's Mike Garcia reports.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 49, and the joint resolution is passed.
The Senate approved legislation to lift the nation's debt limit Tuesday under a deal struck by party leaders. The measure increases the debt limit by $2.5 trillion until after next year's midterm elections. The party line vote came just one day ahead of a deadline set by Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who had warned she was running out of options to avoid what would be the nation's first ever default. The measure now goes to the House, where approval is needed before it goes to President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. Mike Gracia, Washington.
President Biden, in a video Tuesday, sent his sympathies to the families of the victims of the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and demanded that Congress take action on his gun control agenda.
We forged a broad coalition and enacted more than 20 executive orders. We came close to legislation, but we came up short. It was so darn frustrating, and it's still frustrating now. For you and me and so many others.
U.S. President Joe Biden, Afghan survivors of a mistaken U.S. drone strike in August that killed 10 members of their family, said that they want the U.S. to act. AP's Rita Foley has more.
The Hellfire missile slammed into Zemari Ahmadi's car, killing him and 9 relatives, including 7 children, in the chaotic final days of the U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. General Frank McKenzie, head of U.S. Central Command, called the strike a tragic mistake. But 3 of Ahmadi's brothers, sitting just a few feet from where the missile struck in August, say they've heard nothing from Washington about financial compensation or whether they might be evacuated to keep them safe from criminals who are threatening them. To try to get the money, many people think the U.S. has already paid them. John Kirby, chief Pentagon spokesman, says the U.S. is ready to pay the Ahmadi's compensation and potentially get them out of Afghanistan. But he says the U.S. wants it done as safely as possible. I'm Rita Foley.
British lawmakers voted to approve new restrictions to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of coronavirus, but many had more than public health on their mind. AP's Charles Deladesma reports.
The House of Commons is voting on measures that come into force this week, requiring masks to be worn indoors in England and, contentiously, requiring proof of vaccination or a negative test to enter places like nightclubs and other crowded events. The votes are also an opportunity to express unhappiness with embattled Prime Minister Boris Johnson, whose approval ratings, both with voters and inside his own Conservative Party, have plunged amid ethics scandals and allegations the government breached its own pandemic restrictions. Charles de Ledesma, London.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated a strong U.S. commitment to its strategic partnership with Indonesia, vowing to deepen maritime cooperation with Southeast Asia's most populous nation. Blinken made the remarks after a meeting with Indonesian counterpart Retno Marsudi and the signing of several joint agreements. During his trip to the Indonesian capital of Jakarta, Blinken described the Indo-Pacific as the world's most dynamic region and said everyone had a stake in ensuring a status quo that was without coercion and intimidation, in a barely veiled reference to China.
We have a strong commitment to the strategic partnership with Indonesia and a strong commitment to our engagement across the Indo-Pacific as an Indo-Pacific nation ourselves. So we are deepening our cooperation on maritime issues, including maritime security, resource management and fisheries conservation, safety and navigation, economic activity, science and technology. In this region, where so much happens by sea, and particularly so much commerce happens by sea, and at a critical moment when the climate crisis threatens our oceans, our waterways, our coasts, marine life, cooperation on maritime issues is particularly vital, and I would argue more important than ever.
Secretary Blinken is making his first visit to Southeast Asia since President Joe Biden took office in January, a trip aimed at shoring up relations after a period of uncertainty about U.S. commitment to Asia under the administration of President Donald Trump. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. France is pulling its troops from a key military base in the northern Malian city of Timbuktu. French forces have been operating in the region since 2013 with a mission to fight jihadist insurgents that were destabilizing the area. France's foreign ministry recently condemned an attack that killed 7 United Nations peacekeepers and several others wounded by an improvised explosive device. Regional analysts have often pointed to what they say are major shortcomings in the anti-terror campaigns waged by France and other actors in the region. Given that extremists continue to be a security threat in Mali and other countries in the Sahel. Catherine Field is a reporter and analyst based in Paris. She talks to me about the basis for France starting this operation and if they have achieved the goals set out by former French President François Hollande in 2013.
This particular mission, this anti-jihadist mission, dates back to 2013. And the then president of France was called to help out the Malian government, who were concerned that jihadists were going to overrun the capital of Mali, Bamako. So the French went in there with troops. And of course, as we remember, that operation was called Serval. It then was renamed into Operation Barkhane. And we have to remember back to those days when, in fact, the French at that time were welcomed not just in Bamako, but also in Timbuktu as heroes.
And now that the mission is closing, has France achieved its goals or its mission?
No, it hasn't, not at all. What has changed is how much France is prepared to stay in the region, particularly the Sahel region, when it sees that some of the key players aren't really stepping up to the plate to be able to do what France expects them to do. President Macron is a younger president. He's the first French president who has been born after the colonial era. So he doesn't have the baggage that a lot of the others had. And in fact, President Macron's idea has always been that France will never substitute for state forces, whether they be the force of a government or whether they be the military forces. And he's always said this. So this drawdown that we're seeing, this leaving the last of the three bases in northern Mali, very much goes along with the line that they will help out, but they will not replace local officials. And that's what he feels, that he just can't underwrite this anymore. Mm. Certainly, it does look like a retreat.
Now, what does Mali think about this move? Is the army, the local army, able to secure the country and contain the threat of extremist attacks?
No, they certainly aren't. And there are two big issues at stake now. So who's going to go into this area? Who is going to be the key player in northern Mali? Well, one of the big problems there is back to where we were. Al-Qaeda affiliates, Islamic State affiliates, who have been in that area for so long, they will take up that bit of territory. That's what it's feared. What the French are hoping for is that this sort of new European force called Tabuka will take over and will do they will be the backbone of that. But the problem is that you've got very few countries within Europe who are prepared to put their forces there. You do have a Swedish, a Czech, and Italian forces as part of that. But it's a very small and a very separate European defense force. Another part of it is that the French really do not want to do patrols anymore. They do not want to have their forces on the front line. So what they're relying on is really air support. Now, that air support comes from the Americans. They want the Americans to give more logistical support, particularly from their base in Niger.
And I remember that was part of the conversation right after that whole kerfuffle with the submarine deal between the U.S. and Australia, where I think France was requesting that the Americans maintain support in that region in terms of collecting intelligence.
Indeed, that was really, if you like, that was the payback that French President Emmanuel Macron wanted, that Emmanuel Macron and his defense and foreign ministers were all saying that they were taken very much by surprise that America, Australia and the United Kingdom had done this deal behind their back and that the French were left out of it. And in return, President Macron was pretty tough when he said, OK, well, this is what we expect in return. We expect those logistical bases in Niger to be kept open and to be used for that particular purpose. But, you know, Jackson, there is another component that we've got to look at, which is how the French public view this engagement in Mali, particularly the human toll as well as the financial cost. 52 French soldiers have died in combat there, and it's harder and harder for the French president to tell his electorate that they need to be there, when in fact what they're looking at is that they just can't really get any further there, and it's going to be easier to sell to the French electorate if they say, okay, we're moving out of northern Mali, we're coming further down to the south, and from those bases in the south, the French troops will actually be able to secure the far more precious region, which is Côte d'Ivoire and Senegal, where a lot of French companies have got financial resources there.
That was Catherine Field. She's a reporter and analyst based in Paris. Voice of America! Gambia's opposition United Democratic Party, UDP, is seeking the intervention of the country's Supreme Court to annul the recently concluded elections, the first elections since the fall of longtime dictator Yahya Jammeh. Incumbent President Barrow won the elections with 53.2% of the vote after an unprecedented turnout of close to 90% of registered voters. For an update on this situation, I'm joined by Sene Marena, the founder and editor of Alkamba Times, a Gambia-focused digital news platform.
Lawyers for the opposition United Democratic Party filed their formal election petition to the highest court in the Gambia, that's the constitutional court called the Supreme Court, to challenge the December 4th presidential election that shows incumbent president Adama Barrow winning in a landslide. They are claiming they want the court to nullify the result and, if possible, declare Usainu Dabo as president. So the lawyers are saying they have evidence to back up their claim.
And what is some of the evidence that they have produced or they're going to produce in court to show that there was a widespread rigging?
According to the petition that I personally saw, one of the claims is that they use the chiefs, the Alkalul, and the local government authorities. And by constitution, those people should not participate in the politics. So they said they also, bribe, electorates by giving them milling machines to, influence them to vote for the NPP. Another claim submitted by the UDP is the fact that, they promised these local government authorities that they will be provided salaries after the elections.
Now, is this the first of its kind appeal to this court, to the Supreme Court in the Gambia? Have there been any previous appeals in the past elections?
If you recall, in 2016, when ex-president Yahya Jammeh was defeated by current president Adama Barrow, Jammeh claimed that, the election was rigged And then he wanted to take the matter to the Supreme Court of the Gambia. But then what happened was that the Supreme Court, which consists of at least 7-6 judges, you know, were not in full. You know, so it could, his petition then could not be heard in court because there was no quorum at the Supreme Court. So when the new administration came in 2017, there was what we call Gambianization of the judiciary. So all the 6 appointed justices of the Supreme Court are all Gambians now, meaning the court have a quorum to, you know, to sit on this particular case. So this is not the first time. Yaya Jammeh has attempted it in 2016, but he could not succeed, you know, leaving him to go into exile in Equatorial Guinea. So basically, according to many experts on the ground, this is a test for our new democracy. So people are now resorting to legal, you know, processes to ensure that, you know, their grievances are addressed. If you remember, during the nomination, the IEC, which is the electoral body mandated to conduct election, rejected some of the candidates. So they went to the High Court, and the High Court ruled in favor of those aggrieved parties, ordering the IEC to include them in the presidential election. But the IEC, in turn, you know, did not apply the court order. So basically, Gambians are, you know, testing the courts now to ensure that there is rule of law, justice, and, you know, human rights.
That was Sene Marena, founder and editor of Alkamba Times, a Gambia-focused digital news platform. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warns Afghanistan is facing a profound human rights crisis and failure by the Taliban rulers to uphold the rights of their people, and it will lead to further turmoil and hinder the country's development. The High Commissioner's report has been presented at a special session of the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This unrelentingly bleak report describes a society where millions of people are unable to meet their basic needs because of the near collapse of the Afghan economy. It says people suffering poverty and hunger are forced to take desperate measures to survive, including child labor, child marriage, and even the sale of children. Before the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in August, the United Nations recorded the highest number of civilian casualties on record, with women and children among the main victims. While casualty numbers have dropped, the report says civilians continue to be killed in attacks by various armed groups. UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, tells the Council extrajudicial killings are increasing across the country. She expresses concern at the continued recruitment of children by an extremist jihadist militant group and Taliban authorities.
While the Taliban takeover has brought an uneasy end to fighting against governmental forces in the country, the current situation leaves the population with little protection in terms of human rights. Women and girls in particular face great uncertainty with respect to the rights to education, to livelihoods, and to participation, in which they had made important gains over the past 2 decades.
Al-Nashif says Afghan society will pay a high price if the Taliban continue to marginalize women by depriving them of an education, prohibiting them from working, and keeping them under the control of a male relative.
The continued participation of women in all aspects of life will be fundamental to Afghanistan's future. The UN partners have estimated that restricting women from working could contribute an immediate loss of up to $1 billion, or up to 5% of the country's GDP. As more and more girls are held back and pushed further behind, that economic and social damage will accumulate for future generations.
The UN Credentials Committee has decided to not allow the Taliban to represent Afghanistan at the United Nations. So Nasser Andisha, ambassador to the UN in Geneva under ex-president Afghan Ghani's regime, remains the person who the UN recognizes as the legitimate representative of Afghanistan. In taking the floor at the Council, the ambassador thanked the High Commissioner for her report. He called on the international community to side with the people of Afghanistan and to not allow the Taliban to deprive them of their fundamental rights and freedoms. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is in Australia for talks with Prime Minister Scott Morrison. Analysts have said that enhancing defense ties is a priority of the four-day visit. That, along with China's growing regional influence. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is the first world leader to arrive since Australia closed its borders to most foreign travellers in March 2020. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison welcomed Moon and South Korea's First Lady Kim Jong-suk to Canberra on Monday.
I'm so pleased we could join together, as we have been threatening to do for many years now through COVID, and we can now come together in this way, and I'm so pleased to be able to host you and to formally elevate our relationship to a comprehensive strategic partnership.
The leaders have agreed on several new joint initiatives around clean energy technology, the supply of critical minerals, and defence. Under a new deal worth $771 million, the South Korean company Hanwha will provide 30 howitzers, ammunition supply vehicles, and radars to detect enemy artillery. It's the largest military contract between Australia and an Asian nation. Analysts have said South Korea is also well placed to win a contract with Australia worth $21.3 billion for new infantry attack vehicles. Speaking through an interpreter, Moon said the two countries were committed to an open, inclusive and prosperous Indo-Pacific region.
Korea and Australia uphold the same values, and our position in terms of the geopolitical situation, we are like-minded. Therefore, Korea is focused on a steadfast alliance with the U.S. and also with China. We want a harmonized relationship.
Moon is the first South Korean president to come to Australia in more than a decade. Haley Channer, a senior policy fellow with the Perth US Asia Centre, says Moon's visit is significant.
Australia's often looked across the table and seen South Korea and seen that it's preoccupied with developments on the Korean Peninsula. But Australia and South Korea have so many different things in common. So having this bilateral visit is extremely important to progress the relationship forward.
This year, the two nations will mark 60 years of diplomatic relations. South Korea is Australia's fourth largest trading partner. A free trade deal has been in place since December 2014. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In other news, testimony resumed for a second day Tuesday in a hearing to determine whether there is enough evidence to order a court-martial for an American sailor charged with setting the fire that destroyed the USS Bonhomme Richard in the summer of 2020. Navy prosecutors allege that May, who is accused of setting the fire last year, was disgruntled after dropping out of Navy SEAL training. May denies igniting the amphibious assault ship that burned for nearly 5 days and injured dozens aboard. His defense lawyer said there is no physical evidence connecting him to the blaze, which marked the Navy's worst warship fire outside combat in recent times. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Nigeria has been recording massive growth in its information technology sector, but only one-fifth of IT workers are women, according to government figures. Aid groups are trying to help women and girls enter the IT world by teaching them about blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
60-year-old Elizabeth Onaji arrives for a weekly cryptocurrency training for women in Nigeria's capital city, Abuja. Since enrolling for the training in June, she says her knowledge about blockchain technology has improved greatly and that she is propagating the message to other women.
I believe that this is a worldwide project or business. Nigeria should not be the odd one out. We should also key into the global trend.
A Nigerian crypto educator Janet Cartio runs the blockchain classes. She began free blockchain education for women in 2017 and says hundreds of Nigerian women have benefited from the training so far.
I'm always interested in teaching women so that they can also be part of what is happening in the technology space. You understand? And then you come to see a lot of women, mothers, are interested, are already taking this blockchain technology and making life out of it. Some are housewife, some are even working.
But Nigeria's technology sector, like many other sectors, has a poor female representation. The country's Statistics Bureau says less than a fifth of IT workers are women, despite major growth in the industry in the last decade. People like Katio are trying to address this problem with blockchain education for women. Nigeria is Africa's biggest blockchain market. During a recent class, she partnered with the non-profit T'Challa Foundation to teach women about an African cryptocurrency called T'Challa, which was introduced in November. Messiah Obuago is a co-founder of the T'Challa Foundation, the nonprofit that introduced the cryptocurrency.
T'Challa is a hero that is coming up from Africa and to save Africa. And what we're trying to say is that it's time for Africa to have a voice in the blockchain space, and also Africa to have a voice when it comes to cryptocurrency.
However, Obuagu says government policies could prove a challenge to the advancement of blockchain technology in Nigeria.
When you speak to people about cryptocurrency, they will try to remind you the government said it's not good for us. You know, it's a big barrier, and people tend to follow that.
In February this year, Nigerian authorities warned citizens against cryptocurrencies, saying they were unstable and insecure and often led to the loss of investments. Authorities in October launched a digital currency known as the e-Naira. But despite the risks and odds, women like Katio and Elizabeth say they will be promoting cryptocurrency training for more women to get involved. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And still in West Africa, Ghana's airport operators said they will fine airlines $3,500 for every passenger they fly into the country who is not vaccinated against COVID-19 or who tests positive on arrival. Kent Mensah has more from Accra, Ghana.
The Ghana Airports Company Limited said in a statement that beginning Tuesday, all arriving passengers 18 years and older must provide evidence of being fully vaccinated against COVID-19. It said for every passenger an airline allows to arrive without proof of vaccination, a negative COVID test result, or who tests positive on arrival, they will be fined $3,500. It added that any non-Ghanaians breaking the new rules may also be refused entry. The statement said Ghanaians will be allowed entry but subject to 14 days of mandatory quarantine at a designated facility. Ghana's health ministry ordered the strict measures on Monday as African countries are facing the challenge of the Omicron variant and getting people vaccinated. Ghana Health Service Director General Dr. Patrikuma Abuaji told a local radio station the measures were needed. He said about 75% of all the people who test positive for the virus at the airport were unvaccinated. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Have a great day, everyone.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.